Welcome to Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk. Here's your host, Jason Davis.
Here we go, Soccer Morning on a Tuesday. Thank you very much for joining us here on WorldSoccerTalk.com. Excited to have you today. Big day, big show. Lots to talk about, whether it's the continued discussion of the state of the U.S. men's national team, some news about where they'll play a home qualifier. We've got Mexico in the news, clearly. Vladimir Putin putting his 2 cents in on one of the biggest prizes known to mankind, and the worthiness of one step bladder. We'll get to that in the news here in a second. First, let me just go ahead and prime the pump. Charlie Bohm from Soccer Wire, MLSsoccer.com and USsoccerplayers.com will join us in a couple of minutes, and we will have a discussion with Charlie about the U.S. women's national team players, the conquering U.S. women's national team players, returning from their World Cup triumph and taking a bit of time, taking their old sweet time, getting back to the NWSL and the competing interest therein and exactly why these things happen and who might be pulling some strings when it comes to these big U.S. women's national team stars. So that's coming up very shortly. We may range into some other areas with Charlie as well, including MLS and the U.S. men's national team. Let's do the headlines here this morning. First up, Miguel Herrera, the continuing drama over his reported hitting of a reporter at the Philadelphia airport yesterday. Rumors swirling that he will be fired today. He does have a meeting with Mexican soccer officials at 11 a.m. Eastern time. That could be the end. Now, I watched Univision last night looking for the video, the supposed smoking gun video showing Miguel Herrera striking the reporter in question at the airport in Philadelphia. And what I saw did not prove a damn thing. I don't know if Miguel Herrera hit anybody, but it's certainly not on video. If there's evidence of this incident that exists, the public hasn't seen it. Perhaps the FMF has seen it. The story goes that the security cameras in that particular area of the Philadelphia airport were down and not working, which just makes you really glad to go to Philadelphia and fly out of there, doesn't it? Or fly into there, for that matter. Miguel Herrera may lose his job, but there's a very strong whiff of politics and the competing television interests in this. And we know this is how Mexico operates. This is not new. When it comes to the hiring and firing of coaches, very often big name players within the Mexican television world have a say in how these things go. I will say that based on what we know, based on the evidence at hand, if Miguel Herrera is fired today, it's a travesty. If he's fired based on that incident, it's flat out wrong. Didier Drogba has officially been announced as a Montreal Impact player. Joey Saputo says it's an honor to welcome Didier Drogba to the Impact. From the first conversation I had with him, I felt that he really wanted to play in Montreal. This is one of the biggest days in club history, and his arrival to the club will be beneficial in every aspect. Now, Chicago Fire, who had the discovery claim on Didier Drogba and were in line to sign him if he chose to play in Chicago, have been compensated with allocation money that they didn't then turned around and used to bring Gilberto back to MLS. The Brazilian striker, formerly of TFC, has joined the Chicago Fire. In fact, the Fire, perhaps a little salty over the way things went down with Mr. Drogba, let slip that Drogba was officially a Montreal Impact player before the Montreal Impact did. So a little gamesmanship within MLS, which is fun and exciting. Michel Platini is expected to announce his candidacy for the FIFA presidency in the next few days. A source close to the former French international told Reuters on Tuesday. Platini is 60 years old. He has been UEFA president since 2007 and is widely expected to throw his hat into the ring to succeed Sepp Blatter, who, of course, will be replaced as FIFA president early next year. February 26th is when the special elective Congress will be held in Zurich. Now, Platini is such a shoe-in that he is the far and away odds-on favorite with the bookies. He is not necessarily a reform candidate. He is certainly a man who is notorious for having backed the Qatari World Cup bid and the close ties between the Qataris and French football officials and French government officials. have been noted in regards to Platini and his leadership, both of UEFA and his potential leadership of FIFA. U.S. Soccer has announced that there will be a World Cup qualifier played in St. Louis at St. Louis's Busch Stadium, that is home of the St. Louis Cardinals. Yes, that's a baseball stadium. This game will take place on November 13th of this year. It'll feature the United States versus the winner of the St. Vincent and Grenadines and Aruba match, which is a third-round CONCACAF qualifying matchup pitting two of the lower-ranked sides in the region. Tickets go on sale August 5th at 10 a.m. Central Time. St. Louis fans and people going to that game can get them at ussoccer.com. Questions as to whether it's smart to play a game on a baseball field, but this is going to be a special event for St. Louis, and certainly I would argue it probably beats putting down the sod over the top of the artificial surface in the dome there in St. Louis. And of course, this is smack dab in the middle of football season, so I imagine it would be difficult to schedule around the St. Louis Rams with this game happening in November. Russian President Vladimir Putin, because we know that we need his take on this very issue, has said that Sepp Blatter should be given the Nobel Prize. "People like Blatter deserve special recognition," said Vladimir Putin. "Let's have Nobel Prizes for people like that." On Saturday, Blatter told Putin that the Russian people can be proud of him. This is at the World Cup qualifying draw in St. Petersburg on Saturday. Vladimir Putin said in a Swiss interview recorded on Saturday in St. Petersburg that he was sure Blatter was not corrupt. He added, by making allegations against FIFA, "The Americans and their allies in Britain were continuing to fight the World Cup bidding contest. Both the United States and Britain obviously lost. England lost the bid for the 2018 for the 2022 and 2018 World Cup bids, respectively." So, you know, if Vladimir Putin has any say in it, Blatter will get that Nobel Prize he so covets. Edinson Cavani has been suspended for two matches for Uruguay after his confrontation with Chile's Gonzalo Jara at the Copa America. Remember, Jara put his finger somewhere he shouldn't have. Cavani reacted, and now Cavani will miss two matches in World Cup qualifiers for Uruguay. I'm trying to find which matches he'll actually miss. Those are actually scheduled. Bolivia and Colombia on October 8th and October 12th. Oscar Tavares has also been, the head coach of Uruguay, has also been suspended for three matches from the sideline for something he did. I don't even know. This is whatever. It's ridiculous. You get a finger in a place, you respond. I don't care who you are. Let's take a break. When we come back, Charlie Bohm will join us. Good old friend Charlie Bohm from MLS Soccer, Soccer Wire, and US Soccer Players. Don't go anywhere. Be right back.
Facing the crowd, you're talking too loud.
Welcome back to Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk with Jason Davis.
We are back. We are live. We are Tuesday. Well, we're not Tuesday. Today is Tuesday. Let's have a discussion about the U.S. Women's National Team, those players who lifted a World Cup in Canada, and the protracted story that is their return to the NWSL with Charlie Bohm from Soccer Wire, which is where the piece in question is posted. He also writes at MLSsoccer.com. USsoccerplayers.com, and I'm sure many other places. He is at CBOEHM on Twitter. Charlie, how are you this morning?
Doing great. Glad to be here with you, Jason.
It's good to have you. Okay, so the headline to your piece over at Soccer Wire, which people absolutely 100% have to read, is "What's taken the U.S. Women's National Team so long to return to NWSL action?" And I think it's a question a lot of people have been asking, while it's okay and understandable that they had a celebration tour of some type and you just won a World Cup and that hasn't happened in 16 years, there's a feeling that this has been going on too long. First of all, let's take stock. Who's returned and who hasn't returned? And I know that we have a couple of injuries in the mix as well.
Yeah, Jason, I don't have a lineup in front of me or, you know, a roster sheet to run down it individually, but I can tell you that there were players rejoining their teams at least to make appearances and be honored at their NWSL matches as little as 1 week after the World Cup final in Vancouver on the 5th of July. So there were teams back in their markets, in a week's time. But they're in terms of actually making their returns to the field and playing in match action, that was kind of a trickle. I think it was the first players were back maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks or so after the World Cup final. And then there was a round of players that only just this past weekend made their debuts to, you know, return to match action. So it's kind of been, and this is what made me sort of interested to dig into this a little bit more. It was an uneven sort of situation, and it wasn't clear what the pattern or what the plan was for this. So that's kind of what this grew out of.
Yeah, there's a lot of competing interest here. Clearly, the NWSL teams want their star players back as soon as possible to capitalize on all the momentum created by the Women's World Cup. U.S. Soccer may want to publicize the victory as much as possible to bring more attention to the team and to the program, et cetera, and so forth. The players themselves have various interests in when to go back to their NWSL teams and how much to push the envelope on their notoriety, because let's be fair to them, you know, earning power is a thing that is fleeting sometimes, Charlie. And I guess, how do we line these things up? And really, is it fair to just say that the NWSL clubs have that they have been wronged here? Is that fair, or are we going too far if we say it that way?
No, I don't think this is a black and white scenario by any means. And I tried to do my best without running into many thousands of words. I tried to shade out some of those variations in the piece because, these players are world champions, and most of their male counterparts, for example, you know, when Germany won the World Cup in Brazil last summer, they had weeks, if not more than a month, of recovery time, both physical, psychological, mental, after, you know, a really draining tournament. And we all saw what happened to the U.S. men's national team when they came back, even just from a four-game, you know, round of 16 run. There was mental and physical exhaustion, and it was clear. And some of them are only just now really getting back to their best soccer. So there is a case to be made for these players getting an extended break. But the nature of the beast in women's soccer is that the domestic season here in the United States is, it's a summer season. It's a spring to fall season. And multiple sources made it clear to me that there had been what was described to me as an ironclad agreement in writing between NWSL owners, who are, you know, they run their league. It is sort of a branch of U.S. soccer, if that makes sense. It's underwritten by U.S. Soccer. U.S. Soccer pays the salaries of the big players, the national team stars. But NWSL owners still have a lot of freedom. They get to vote and decide matters as a group. But apparently the owners, the players, the federation all had agreement. These players would be back in market within 5 days after the conclusion of the World Cup. These players leave their national team camp. At any time they gather for national team events, they're medically evaluated when they arrive. They're medically evaluated when they leave, and they're deemed either fit or unfit to play upon their departure. And so you have that question: can these players physically, mentally, are they prepared to resume club play? And then there was the sort of more murky question of, you know, is this the right time? Are they ready? What do they deserve as individuals? What does the national team deserve in terms of promotion? What does NWSL deserve in terms of promotion? And the interests sometimes point in the same direction, but they don't all necessarily align. So it's a complex situation.
I think what was fascinating to take out of your piece as well is sort of the... We know the NWSL operates on a shoestring budget. I think a lot of people are learning just how shoestring that budget really is. And obviously there are practical reasons for that. I mean, after the death of WUSA and WPS, it's smart to run a league with a budget in mind, especially as you know, growing the fan base is something that's not going to come overnight, and you're not going to have a large influx of cash. But what we've got here is, as the incubation of women's soccer has happened over the last 30 years for the women's national team, the women's national team has become such an elite unit, you know, and it's so highly funded, Charlie, as compared to the club game, that you have, I mean, for lack of a better word, sort of a closed off click of players who, it's been pointed out, and not by you, but I believe this was a direct quote by one of your sources, that they don't necessarily want to open up and allow people, players to get better in NWSL to compete for the spots that they hold, because those are cushy spots that bring them good incomes.
Well, you know, the killer app, as I've described in the past, of NWSL, the idea that was supposed to make this league more sustainable, more affordable, and make it work for the long term in a way that its predecessors did not, was, you know, getting the Canadian, the Mexican, and the United States federations together, you know, attaching league participation to the national team duties of the player, you know, pool of those national teams. The idea was that would, you know, give these players a place to play. It would take, you know, them being star players, it would take those biggest salaries off the backs of the owners and the clubs, in order to give them more, you know, more of a fighting chance financially. But I think the unforeseen consequence that resulted from that situation is that you now have something of a conflicting loyalty, right? You have players who've maybe been part of the national team longer than NWSL has existed.
Right.
And you're asking them to carry a dual allegiance. And we all take that for granted at the men's level, right?
Right.
These players are, you know, Clint Dempsey has loyalty to the Seattle Sounders, but he also has loyalty to his country. And there's certainly complications in terms of the, you know, those interests aligning. But for the most part, we know he's going to do everything he can for his country, but then he goes home to the club that pays him, that employs him year round. In the women's game, it's a different matter, especially with the women's national team, where those players are full-time employees of the federation. And thus they are, you know, if they feel that their spot has been earned already, they may not necessarily be as inclined to go out and have to prove that every day in a much more bare bones environment at the NWSL level. You know, I mean, as I detailed in the piece, the experience these players have is so different on national team duty than it is on NWSL duty. And we just saw just yesterday, you know, the news was officially released by U.S. Soccer that two players are retiring at the end of this season, Lauren Holiday and Shannon Box. They're both going to spend time with the Victory Tour. But one is going to finish out her season with FC KC, and Lauren Holiday says she's motivated to win a second straight NWSL title with her club, whereas Shannon Box, who spent really more time with the national team than with her club because of injuries and a variety of other factors, is not going to return to the Chicago Red Stars. So it's a tough situation. I don't necessarily blame players for feeling allegiance to their their national team over their club. But it means that you don't necessarily have a fully equitable situation.
Right. I mean, it boils down to the fact that they're making the lion's share of their income comes from the national team. Certainly that's the higher profile team. It gets more attention. You know, there's a lot much larger fan base. Let's be honest about it. They're not making their money at the club level. And the players that are all at the club level that aren't part of the national team, meanwhile, just to put this into some context, because this is outlined in your story, they can be paid as little as $6,800 a year, a season, and the maximum wage in the league is $37,800 maximum. So the national team is making 10 times that much money, Charlie, in some cases, from the national team. And even the best players in NWSL who are not national teamers aren't even topping out at 10% of that salary. So it's obviously a very strange situation.
It is. It's especially odd to hear. You know, I applaud those who are who become aware of the discrepancy in World Cup bonus winnings between the men and the women, which is something like, what, $35 million for winning the men's World Cup versus $2 million for the women's World Cup. I think that's an issue to be addressed and discussed. But it is odd to hear people advocate for paying the U.S. women's national team more when they are by far at the top of the pyramid, not just in American women's soccer, but in world soccer, women's soccer. No one is making anywhere near as much money as them. No one has access to anywhere near as many sponsorship opportunities. You know, you have my general, you know, from tax documents and other sources, we can say that women's national teamers are making anywhere between $150,000 to $300,000 sort of base pay per year. And then this year, they're going to make significantly more than that because of the bonus money from winning the World Cup and the bonus money from these victory tour matches, which are significant payday for both the Federation and the players.
You know, Charlie, this is part of the legacy of the 99ers, and I don't begrudge any athlete, considering how short the window of athletic prominence is, the right to go earn as much money as they possibly can. If a player makes a move because they get a bigger contract, good for them, because you never know when you're going to tear a ligament or break something, or it's just going to all go away. But at the same time, it does sort of crystallize the problem here that the women's club game is at such a disadvantage. It almost brings to mind the very question. And now that we're on the third attempt at a league in this country, there's reason to wonder if it's even possible to grow the club game organically, because there is this gigantic impediment in the way, and that is the popularity, the profitability of the women's national team, the clout that those players have once they walk into that team, once they're given a spot. I don't want to be fatalistic about it, but how does a club league go about getting itself off the ground when there is always going to be this looming shadow that is the U.S. women's national team?
Well, you know, a U.S. soccer source that I spoke with last week emphasized that, you know, the source felt that there was too much negativity around this matter, that all the exposure that these players are getting by going on going to the award shows, the ESPYs, the talk shows, that all that is priceless exposure for the game as a whole, and that the rising tide lift all boats, and what benefits the women's national team will benefit NWSL, and it should be all seen in a positive light. But the issue is, you know, there's this confusion about who is looking out for who. You know, I think people assumed when NWSL was founded, and there's, you know, more than $1 million a year of U.S. Soccer Federation funding is going towards it. You know, the Federation explicitly created and is explicitly pledged to support this professional league. And yet it appears not only, you know, we talked about, well, during the World Cup, well, should there be more cross promotion? Should the NWSL, you know, be running ad spots? Which is effectively a question that should be asked of the Federation. You know, that the NWSL would be working with the Federation on this. But my understanding, I was told that the Federation made an explicit decision not to do that, not to promote NWSL during the Women's World Cup, which is a little bit baffling. But when you spend more time around the situation, the Federation simply views it as a lower priority. The Federation is not going to put anything NWSL related ahead of its goals and plans for the women's national team, which is the cash cow that effectively underwrites so much of NWSL. But obviously there's that tension there. You know, it's unclear how you can raise the prominence of NWSL. And I think there's a tough education process. These 26 million people that watch the Women's World Cup final, these explosive, enormous ratings and these huge audiences, how many in that audience understand that, you know, the thing that makes this team so good is depth, is competition, is a league to play in year round. I think that's a message that maybe a lot of the casual fans haven't quite absorbed.
Yeah, and you know, you did point this out earlier, and I just want to come back to it. This issue of the differing conditions under which these players play when they're with the national team versus when they're with their NWSL team. I mean, here's just a key graph in your story. Travel is done on the cheap with long bus rides between all but the most far-flung locales, and most clubs can count their number of full-time employees on one or two hands. Outside of Soccer Mad Portland, NWSL crowds rarely hit five figures, and all but a handful of regular season games are broadcast only on YouTube. For star players, it's often a jarring step down, even from their experiences at major NCAA college programs. So you're essentially, you know, this is not necessarily a criticism on the NWSL, which is trying to grow, and this is not for lack of trying. But this is lack of professionalization. I mean, it's lack of professionalism around the league, and that's just a matter of money, Charlie.
To a large extent, you know, and a lot of those were conscious decisions. You know, the WSA, the first women's pro league at the turn of the century, you know, was really bullish in the wake of the 1999 Women's World Cup and the U.S. Championship there, and they blew through $100 million in less than 3 years. You know, enormous amounts of money that, you know, they had more money in some ways than MLS did back at that time. You know, WPS tried to kind of taper that model and tweak it, and NWSL has essentially blown that all out of the water. This is an unapologetically shoestring league. because they've got to make it a winning proposition, or at least a break-even proposition for their owners. They've got to limit the spending on player salaries, which was the biggest, you know, cost, I think, in those first two leagues. So that means that players aren't paid what they're worth. I think they would say that. And I think most executives in the league would acknowledge that too, but it's all about trying to find a way forward, that's sustainable. And so there's, you know, I know in the case of the local team here, the Washington Spirit, they'd done all the modeling coming into the birth of the league. They felt like if they got I think it was either 3,500 to 5,000 a night for their home games, that was going to get them to a break even level, or at least a sustainable loss. And I think people need to have some understanding for the day-to-day grind that these clubs are going through. I mean, MLS is still figuring out how to make money, much less significant amounts of it across the board. And Abyssal's in the same boat. You know, the Portland Thorns made money. There's other clubs that are losing a significant amount of money. So it's easy to spend other people's money in principle, but for the time being, you know, this is what they've got. This is what they've got to work with. Maybe down the road when they grow past the 9 teams they're at now, maybe more MLS teams buy in. There's a few soccer-specific stadium projects around the country that are pending that would make a great home for an NWSL team down the line. So, again, maybe there's an economy of scale here. But it has to be said, even given all those financial limitations, many would argue it's still the top-quality pro league. And it's arguable, but it's one of the top-quality pro leagues in the world, even on those meager resources.
Well, that says something about the state of the women's game at the club level, doesn't it?
There's no other nation can match the depth and the strength of the player pool here in the United States. And then over on top of that, because of the contrasting season schedules, you can draw a lot of world stars over from Europe or from Japan. In some cases, there's still an attractiveness to coming to play in the States in the off season. So, there's women that are effectively between loan deals and playing in different countries. They're playing almost year round. One, so they can stay sharp, and two, so they can, you know, they can continue to make money year round. And I think that experience, there's a lot to be said for that. And those women deserve a lot of credit for doing that. So I think, the NWSL, the quality of play, I think it's going to continue to grow. It's maybe not quite what people are accustomed to have watched in the last month or so here with the Women's World Cup. But if you invest a little bit, you can get a lot out of this league in terms of watching it, paying attention. There's some very interesting storylines and that sort of thing. So, it's just a question, I think, of giving this baby time to grow.
Sure. Time is always the key factor here. Just making sure these clubs exist. I've been preaching that with MLS for a very long time, or any club, any professional club in the United States, men's, women, whatever level, just keep existing somehow, whatever you need to do to keep those fans engaged and to keep that fan base growing. Charlie, one factor we really haven't talked about in the delayed return of some of these players to their team is sort of the agent angle. I mean, you mentioned this. How large of a role do agents play in how the big name stars from the U.S. Women's National Team go about their business month to month, week to week?
That's significant. You know, for the players that are considered, major figures, that are marketable figures, that have personas that transcend the game, their agents and agencies in a lot of cases here are full service outlets. They're going to help you with your social media. They're not just going to negotiate your contract. They're going to build your personal brand. They're going to help you ink sponsorship deals. They're going to help you connect with your fans better. So it's sort of a full stop, a one-stop shop, I should say. There's a lot of value that comes from that. The issue is, there's only, because of the salaries are smaller, there's a lot of agents who are working for free in this business, and I give them a lot of credit, who are working for very small amounts, whose women's soccer branch is maybe built off of more profitable representation of other sports and that being said, these agents are looking out for their players, and these players are doing the same in a lot of cases. I think, and I won't speak for any of them, but I think that a lot of these players feel like this is a very rare moment they have, a very rare window in the sun, and not just the soccer media's attention, but in the mainstream spotlight. And so they're determined to max it out. And you have to give them credit. I mean, there's when even players who aren't necessarily established stars or established starters are inking big sponsorship deals. There's money to be made there. There's exposure to be gained. I think where it got complicated or messy was, despite the fact that the federation and the clubs of NWSL thought they had an agreement. Things got a little messy. Players, it was a question literally of, is this player going to get on this plane to be at this time in that week or two after the Women's World Cup final? And that was where, you know, it ended up sort of the egg flew on NWSL's face and the federation's face. But in a sense, you know, and I think the federation probably looked worse because, okay, where are your players? Are they reporting, you know, where they're supposed to be? They're at your event, or are they at their NWSL event and so forth? But my understanding is, you know, even guys like major figures like Darren Revelle were ripping NWSL clubs for maybe not always making it super clear what Women's World Cup stars were going to be where and were they going to be on the field. But in a lot of cases, they didn't know. They'd entered that period thinking they had an agreement with the players in the federation. The federation thought they had that sorted out. They thought that their players would be responsive to the agreement they had made, and it wasn't always the case.
Sure, and just again, just goes to show you that the clubs have limited influence; they're not equal partners in all of this. I mean, the federation might not knowing is an indication of something too. But clearly, if the clubs were as influential as the men's clubs are in the careers of their players, and certainly they're paying the salaries in those cases, most of the money those players make comes from their club, then they're going to know, or they're going to be players in this. They're going to be demanding things. They're going to be in communication. That's not necessarily the case here. A couple of things, Charlie, and by the way, Darren Revelle, I know some people don't like him too much. He made good points in these tweets that Charlie embedded in the story, at Soccer Wire. Carly Lloyd was traded from the Western New York Flash to the Houston Dash last year. She's obviously the big name star in terms of her play coming out of the World Cup, scoring the hat trick in the final. She scored on the weekend against the Flash. This is a little mini controversy. Is this ultimately good for NWSL, or is this the kind of thing they need to avoid right now?
Well, I think this is a question we debate on the men's side as well, especially in the MLS context, right? Everybody wants to have press, but then they typically want to only get good press, and they lash out against bad press. But to me, if Darren Revelle is talking about you, even if you don't agree with what he says, or if you don't feel he's being fair, you grab what you can, and you use that to sort of wrench your way into the debate, into the wider spotlight. And I think in the case of Carly Lloyd, absolutely. I mean, this is a the timing here is kind of fortuitous in a sense for us, at least for the popcorn eating masses, because she's at her career's peak right now. She's playing excellently. She's recognized right now as the top player in the world. She's a World Cup match winner, and she happens to run into the team that she felt did her wrong in the offseason. And as I tweeted afterwards, you know, for her to go public, it's a little bit late now. It's you know, months and months after the deal was made, but she was fuming for weeks and weeks after that deal was made. In fact, I was told that she was threatening retirement. That's how angry she was about the trade to Houston. You know, because it took her away from her personal trainer, her coach James Galanis. She took her away from her roots. You know, she's a lot farther from her New Jersey home now. You know, and all those things are things that every player has to contend with. You know, if you're traded, if you have to make a move for career reasons. In her case, she's run into this team. It's given her convenient motivation to continue playing at a high level. And I think it's great for the league. And if players want to continue to talk that way and be that outspoken in the press, go for it. You know, just recognize we're probably going to be waiting for you to raise your game on the field as well as in front of the microphones.
All right, last thing here, Charlie, something of a philosophical question for NWSL, but also obviously a practical marketing issue. How difficult is it for that league to develop stars that don't play for the U.S. Women's National Team?
Well, we have to point out there's already a couple successes, even with a very established Women's National Team group coming into this World Cup cycle. Several of the most important players probably wouldn't be on that team if it wasn't for NWSL. I mean, Julie Johnson was on the outs. She wasn't even named to the CONCACAF World Cup qualifying roster last year. And then she goes from on the outside there to hauling herself into a starting spot and being, you know, one of the best players of the tournament. I think that should give fans a hint as to just how many other players are out there. I think there's a lot more players that can make that kind of impact if they get the opportunity. But you know, she owes her chance in large part to playing well on a week in, week out basis with the Chicago Red Stars. You know, Ashlyn Harris got the, you know, won a crowded competition for the backup spot behind Hope Solo, in large part because she was one of the NWSL's best goalkeepers. So I think there's a lot more players out there that can make that sort of impression. And I think, I mean, personally, I would argue that there are more that could have wrenched their way onto the World Cup roster if there had been a little bit more openness on the part of Jill Ellis, you know, to call those players in. But, you know, let's hope that Ellis turns the page at some point. It may not come between now and the Olympics next summer. She may stick with her incumbent roster for the next year. But at some point, sooner or later, there's going to be turning of the page and there's going to be NWSL standouts who are going to get the chance to shine for their country. And I think people will be surprised at how high the level remains.
All right, Charlie Bohm, MLSsoccer.com, SoccerWire.com. Go find this story about the return of the U.S. women to the NWSL at SoccerWire.com. He also writes with me at USSoccerPlayers.com. Charlie, before I let you go, last question here is, do you know where Preki is? Where is Preki?
I put in a few inquiries because I'm curious, because he's one of my favorite characters in the American game. It's very unclear what's happened with Preki. It's a whole different dogfight over there in England.
I'm so worried.
But my guess is if things didn't work out the way he expected them to in England, he is he's back in his Chicago where he had lived before taking the Sacramento job, which is where he'd made his home after leaving Toronto. So that would be my guess.
Right, Charlie.
But I don't have confirmation.
I just hope that somebody didn't make Preki a promise and then renege on that promise, because I don't know that that's something you want to do to Preki. That's all I'm saying.
Preki's a no-nonsense guy, and I don't think it'll be too long before he works again. But then again, he had to wait a shamefully long time to get his gig in Sacramento.
He did.
So we shall see.
Yep, let's see if MLS team brings him back. Yeah, as you mentioned, maybe Chicago. Charlie Bohm joining us on Soccer Morning. Charlie, thank you very much for your time. You can continue your drive now. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Jason.
There goes Charlie. Good stuff from him. When we come back, the phone lines will be open. You can answer for me, where is Preki? We'll talk about MLS, U.S. Women's National Team, all of those things. Soccer Morning, worldsoccertalk.com.
Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk with Jason Davis.
Here we are back on a Tuesday edition of Soccer Morning right here on worldsoccertalk.com. Thank you very much for listening, for joining in. Phone lines are open, 646-832-3909. We are also on Twitter at Soccer Morning and at DavisJSN. I am happy to take your comments and criticisms for the most part, as long as you don't throw name calling into the mix. I mean, come on, really? Name calling, people. We can talk about Jurgen Klinsmann some more if you want. This can be your forum. I've said my piece on Klinsmann. I'm sort of done expressing my frustrations with Jurgen Klinsmann. Some people believe that he's got some long-term program. That's fine. That's great. Let's hope that's the case, because no matter what frustrations I might have and what frustrations I might express, the bottom line is he's not getting fired. He's not going anywhere. Sunil Gulati is pot committed. He's got all of that money in on Jurgen Klinsmann. The man is going to take the United States to October 9th. He's going to play Mexico at the Rose Bowl. The chips will fall where they may, and we'll see what happens after that for this team. But it will ultimately be Jurgen Klinsmann's team. Maybe what we should be focusing on, since Jurgen Klinsmann is unlikely to go anywhere, is just figuring out whether or not the pressure he is under is enough. Because that's what he talks about all the time, right? I feel like I'm answering the bell, and everybody else who is levying some criticism on Jurgen Klinsmann is just answering the bell that he has himself rung. The bell that is bring pressure to this soccer environment, because America is too low-key. We're all too laid back. We don't care enough. We don't put enough pressure on our players, and we don't put enough pressure on our coaches. Let's turn up the heat a little bit. Let's ratchet it up. Let's put some pressure. does appear that Michel Platini has officially announced his candidacy to take over for Sepp Blatter next February in that special FIFA election. Whoop-dee-doop-dee-doo. If you're on board with the Platini train, I don't know what to tell you. It's not going to be any different than what we saw out of Blatter, at least in terms of the aimless, directionless leadership. Certainly, he's going to bow and kowtow to some of the bigger money pressures within the game. He's proven that as UEFA president. He's a man with some interesting ideas that don't always work out the way that he claims they will. He dramatically increased the number of teams taking part in UEFA's European Championships, which has probably lowered the quality of the soccer overall. He has instituted financial fair play, which has proven to be something of a red herring that is more likely than not going to entrench the big money clubs, the established big money clubs, at the expense of new money clubs who want to put whose owners want to put money into their teams to improve their chances of competing on a high level. I mean, that seems to be where Michel Platini falls in the political spectrum that is FIFA. Ultimately, he is a creature of all of those big money interests. Am I wrong about this one? Does anybody think that Platini is an actual reformer? That there's really going to be a change at the top at FIFA if Michel Platini is elected? And he's going to get elected because he has the power base. We know how this works. If you have the blocks necessary, you're going to get elected. He is the odds-on favorite. It would take some out-of-the-blue candidate who can unite Asia, Africa, and probably CONCACAF and the Caribbean nations to oust or to win over Michel Platini at the next election. That's what I would imagine needs to happen here. I did put literally on my rundown for today, and why I threw it in there at the end with Charlie Bowman, it's where's Preki? Hashtag where's Preki? I need to know where he is, because I'm sort of worried that somebody lied to Preki, which I think is bad for the person who lied to Preki. And I'm also concerned about, you know, the guy is a good coach and he was doing good things at Sacramento Republic. And there was a very good chance that if that team got their opportunity to move up to MLS, and let's be fair about it, if it was all about earning it, they would have already been there. If and when that happens, then we would have had Preki back in MLS. He would have had an opportunity to coach in the highest level in this country again. This is a guy who did good things at Chivas USA when nobody else was. Bob Bradley, Preki, that's the list. That's the whole list. He went to Toronto, was operating under a very difficult set of circumstances with leadership and management that did not know what they were doing. And I thought he acquitted himself relatively well. I think people who paid attention to those Toronto FC teams under Preki will tell you they were some of the better teams they've had in their history. And remember, this is a team that's never made the playoffs since entering the league in 2007. So it'd be nice to know where Preki is. Let's go to Ray in Milwaukee. What's up, Ray?
Hey, Jason. How are you? I just like to ask you, how did you feel about the coverage that Fox provided
for the Gold Cup? I didn't have any issues. I mean, I'm sort of easily satisfied. Put the games on. There were a couple of times when we had some shots that were kind of ridiculous. We had a solo shot. I vaguely remember a solo shot of somebody for like an extended period of time while the game was actually happening. That bothered me a bit. I had a couple of missteps from some announcers. I think John Strong actually had a couple of mistakes in there that I wouldn't normally expect him to make. I'm not sure that's his fault or somebody else's fault. So there were some issues, but nothing that really raises to the level of a problem for me, Ray.
Well, you know, I would just like to say that it was a little too much flipping from back and forth. It wasn't constantly on one network at set time, even though there was kind of set time set up. And a lot of people don't have Fox Sports 2. The availability of some of these games.
Yeah, you know, that's not something I had to deal with, Ray, but I absolutely understand anybody who had an issue with the availability of Fox Sports 2 and being able to access all of these games. And it's going to be, we already know that the Bundesliga fans are up in arms over the likelihood that those games are going to be on Fox Sports 2 and Fox Soccer Plus, which is a thing people don't want to pay for anymore. I mean, we're at a point now in the development of soccer on television that the notion of paying for a dedicated channel that is just soccer and having to pay how much is Fox Soccer Plus, Trevor? Is it like $10 a month? If it's something like, I mean, people just don't want to pay that. We pay $10 a month for HBO Go, and that's everything.
All right, I got it. I got to go. Have a good one.
All right, Ray's got to go. Ray's got to run. Something big happened. Something big is going on with Ray. All right. 646-832-3909. Trevor says he doesn't know how much it costs because you get Fox Soccer Plus for free. I get FS2. I get FS2 in HD. I have Fox Sports 1 and Fox Sports 2 in HD. I do not have Fox Soccer Plus because I'm not paying for Fox Soccer Plus. I don't feel that's necessary. Now, I have paid for various streaming options in the past. For Copa America, I paid for a streaming option. I felt okay about that. Copa America isn't necessarily something I would automatically expect to be on American television. Although, I mean, it should be. Let's be honest about that. It should be on American television in HD for me to watch. And everybody else, for that matter. Why is Copa America not free for me? Not free, but part of my cable package. Why is that not a thing? You know, and sometimes you don't even realize what channels you have until you have them. And I don't know. I'm actually in a position now where I pretty much have everything DirecTV has to offer, and I'm not paying the bill. So I can't really comment on this situation too much. I feel like I'm overstepping if I get kind of weird about the TV channels and what's available, considering I'm not paying the bill. 646-832-3909. Call me up. Tell me, where's Preki? Tell me what you think about this story we talked about with Charlie Bowman and the U.S. women. It's a very interesting dynamic because it's essentially the men's game flipped on its head. In the men's game, the clubs have all the power. The clubs are suing national federations over injuries to players. They're suing FIFA. They're demanding compensation when these players go away. And everything flows from the club side. The international game is important. The World Cup is the biggest event. But you always get the sense that the real power lies with the clubs. Because why? Because they pay the salaries of the players. The money that Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi make is not driven from their national team. It's driven from their clubs. So we are headed into a future where a lot of people will tell you, it seems, and maybe not now, maybe not 10 years from now, maybe not 20 years from now, but at some point in the future, it seems likely that the international game may either go away or be replaced by something else, or we'll have some sort of consolidation of the club game, and it will force the international game to respond in some way. Well, something will happen. Some dynamic change will happen, and the international game will suffer. And there's a lot of people will tell you in the modern world that the international game is not nearly the quality of the club game, certainly at the top level, UEFA Champions League and the like. The quality of soccer being played by Barcelona, Real Madrid, Manchester United, Bayern Munich, PSG, Juventus is well far and above anything being played by Argentina, Germany, Brazil, etc., etc. That may not always be true, but there is that general sense. And there's certainly a lot of people now who are club over country. They bemoan the break. I mean, except for the World Cup, they really don't like the fact that we get a bunch of international games that stop the club game during the season. People value their club over their country, or their allegiances to their country are fluid and they change from, you know, whoever's good. They just enjoy the soccer. They're not necessarily tied patriotically. As the world shrinks and as the digital age makes it easier to access everything and less important to tether yourself to a specific nationality and wave your flag, people are becoming more club over country. That doesn't mean there's not a gigantic market for the international game. It just means that there is a shift happening. And on the women's side, it's the complete opposite. There is no developed women's game. Those clubs don't have any power. Everything flows from the international side. These are stars made because of what they do at the World Cup and at the Olympics. Abby Wambach is a star because she scored a ton of goals for the United States women's national team. Carly Lloyd is a star because of what she did for the U.S. Women's National Team and scoring a hat trick in the final and being one of the best, blah, blah, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Alex Morgan is a star for various reasons, including but not limited to her play for the U.S. Women's National Team. That's what gives her the platform to be the celebrity that she is, because she is an amazing player and she does it while wearing the colors of the U.S. Women's National Team. And I think it's a very interesting juxtaposition. Not that I can even draw any conclusions out of it, but you can see that when the international game is prioritized over the club game, or has so much more influence, or is so much more important than the club game, it slows the growth of that club game. The United States may want, the U.S. Soccer Federation and Mexico and Canada to a certain extent, may want a professional women's soccer league to succeed in this country, but they're not going to promote that league and increase its influence at the expense of their national teams. Certainly U.S. soccer is not going to do that with the U.S. women, who, while also being great and can win World Cups, are a cash cow. The U.S. women are going to go on this victory tour across the country, international game, international game, international game, in the middle of the NWSL playoffs this year. And they're going to do that because that's more important. Friendlies in full house stadiums, making money for the federation, making money for the players, increasing their star power, getting them on television, that's all well way more important than playing a weekend game in front of 6,500 at Sky Blue FC, or the 8 to 10, or however many thousand big crowd they get for the Houston Dash, or the Portland Thorns, who get great crowds. The national team is so much more important that those club teams then suffer, and they don't have the money to compete, and they don't pay the salaries of the big name players. So they will always lose out. It's just a very interesting situation. 646-832-3909. If you guys don't call in, we end the show. That's how that works. Where is Preki? Hit me up on Twitter. I want to know. Where is Preki? Lots of comments on Jurgen Klinsmann. I've been called. It's been said that my comments on him are comical. Perhaps you should consider development of young players more vital when World Cup is 3 years away. Again, I have a problem with prioritizing the World Cup over everything, as if the Confederations tournament, the Confederation Cup, or hell, Gold Cup, your own Confederation tournament's not supposed to matter somehow. You should be able to do both. Not sure why Klinsmann can't. Let's see. Daniel, the end goal for Jurgen Klinsmann and the U.S. national team is always a World Cup final win and his way on qualifying to World Cup. If Klinsmann has a World Cup qualifier to playoff, then we should worry. So don't worry now, I guess. Don't worry about losing to Jamaica. Don't worry about the finish in this Gold Cup. Don't worry about the lackluster play through the group stages. Don't worry about his dependence on players or his loyalty to players who showed up and performed poorly over a number of matches. I mean, if the notion is that you stick with them until they come good, that's fine. But again, to do it within this tournament, and then at the end of it to sort of excuse away a bad performance or a bad finish because that's what you were doing, seems very convenient. Jared says, I still don't understand how Jurgen Klinsmann will help youth development. I don't see him coaching kids. The notion apparently is that he brings through young players in the national team and in the national team setup. You do have Todd Ramos in charge of the U-20s. You have Richie Williams at the U-17s. And these guys are supposed to be enacting his program. And maybe that's happening. Maybe that's happening. We've heard from coaches on this show who said that he is enacting reforms that are helping at the lower levels. Whether that's him directly or somebody acting on his behalf, I don't know. I mean, we'll give him credit. He's a technical director. He does, you know, he's in charge. If there's things happening at the youth level that are improving that structure, then he deserves credit for that. But that's not coaching the national team. That's a different thing, clearly. This is where the competing interest of those two jobs may come into play. That's why I'm frustrated. Because Jurgen Klinsmann has the ability to excuse away pretty much anything that happens under his watch, aside from not qualifying for a World Cup, which, God forbid, we get to that point, we're all going to panic. It'll be DEFCON 1. We'll have to, you know, we'll have to blow up the whole system and start over, I guess. I don't know. Now, there's a lot of endemic problems in soccer in the United States of America, but they've always been ones that we could overcome, at least on the top-level international game. At least in terms of our region, at least in terms of qualifying for the World Cup, at least in terms of some of these measuring sticks. And then now suddenly we don't have the ability to get over those anymore, and we have to sacrifice success in the Gold Cup on the altar of developing a pair of center backs? I mean, that doesn't make sense to me. Alexi Lawless has a question. What is my definition of a technical director? My definition of a technical director would be an executive figure who oversees the general health of, this is difficult. The general health of programs related to the development of players from all the way at the very youngest ages of, that kids start playing up until U23s. Let's say it that way. Talking about creating some sort of consistent program, consistent ideals, consistent plan across all of those levels. Directing coaches to focus on specific areas of the game, trying to shift emphases. Is that plural? Trying to shift the emphasis from what has previously been the American dependence on this thing and that thing and moving it to another place. I mean, I'm not even making a value judgment about that necessarily. I'm just saying that that seems to be what he's supposed to do as technical director. Andrew on Twitter, talking point, should MLS make bad defending a league strategy and become as high scoring a circus as possible? Woo! I like that idea, Andrew. Let's do that. Let's just completely discount defending whatsoever. Let's become the Eredivisie on steroids. Can we do that? Can we become that league? If we had five threes every weekend, would that increase the popularity of MLS? No, of course not. I mean, you can't do that. You can't. I mean, it sounds fun, Andrew, but really. Jared says maybe a setup like Major League Baseball scouting system is needed for MLS. And I think that what Jared is suggesting is that MLS go to a pool scouting model. And I think there actually is some sort of shared scouting structure for MLS. Oh, we can get into that. I know there's stories out there on that issue. So there may be people who have some insight into how that works. Last call for phone calls, 646-832-3909. If you have any input here, last second thoughts on Jurgen Klinsmann, on MLS defending on the U.S. Women's National Team, and the return of the players to the NWSL. What else? On where is Preki? I feel like you should know where Preki is, Alexi. If you're listening to the show, where is Preki? All right. Last thing here, I'll hit before I get out of here. Daniel says, "So who is better technical director, Bruce Arena or Jurgen Klinsmann, or is it incomparable?" Difficult. Obviously, it's difficult because we're still trying to determine how we're supposed to judge Jurgen Klinsmann. That's still not clear. We're apparently not supposed to judge him on actual results. We're supposed to judge him on a program over time. He's had 4 years now. I guess he's supposed to get another 4 years before we're allowed to judge him. Now, I'm building a bit of a straw man here based on Dan's tweet, but it certainly seems as though there's some feeling out there that Jurgen Klinsmann's job is only to be evaluated after 2018, despite the fact he's been on the job for 4 years. All right, one more call. Robert in L.A., you're on the line, my friend.
Hey, good morning, friend. I wanted to talk to you a little about L.A. Galaxy coming up in the next month. And, you know, I was looking at the Western Conference Final, and we have, like, a lot of teams that are up there, and they're all close up. And then, like, you know, most of the teams in the West are, because we have Champions League coming up. And I don't know who your CCL expert is, but if you ever have how do you see them handling CCL and MLS play?
Yeah, well, you know what? We'll probably grab John Arnold at some point to talk about that. I don't know exactly. I haven't looked. I know the groups are already out and all that stuff, Robert. I haven't looked at the schedule. CCL has been off my radar, so I apologize. I'll do some research. We'll check in on that. Look at how the Galaxy are going to have to handle that. Look, they've got the depth to do it. I mean, they do. It's just whether or not Bruce prioritizes that tournament, trying to go win another MLS Cup. I mean, he's got issues.
Yeah, I was looking at it, and we have, like, our first two home games are at home before we have to go away to Guatemala but in between we have, like, you know, Seattle and RSL and Vancouver, and they also have CCL, so it'd be very interesting when, and those teams have to go against each other, especially in the month of August, so it's going to be very, and I see, like, you know, them prioritizing and then, like, you know, other teams moving up, like, I don't know if Dallas is going to be able to capitalize and run away with the West.
You don't know if they are? Is that what you said?
No, since Seattle, L.A., Vancouver are
right,
up there.
Right, right,
and they have CCL.
Right.
And they have to compete against each other. And then Dallas doesn't.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're going to use this to, you know, make a gap and, like, you know, run away with the supporters.
I mean, it's possible. I'd have to look at, you know, I need to look at FC Dallas' schedule. Let me see if I can pull that up real quick. Because when does CCL's play start?
Well, it starts next week. But that's for Seattle and Vancouver, and then LA plays the week after that.
Okay. I'm just looking at the upcoming schedule for FC Dallas very quickly, because, as you said, they do have an advantage. They've got Chicago this weekend. Then they're actually off for a week, and they come back. They host LA, Vancouver FC, or Vancouver and Real Salt Lake to close out August, and then Columbus away, New York City at home. This is actually pretty cushy for them in a lot of ways. And they can take points off of Vancouver and LA in that stretch.
Yeah, I want to see if, I have this image. I just want to see Steven Gerrard going to Guatemala and see him play on a crappy pitch.
Oh, I'm sure Robbie Keane has had plenty of conversations with Steven Gerrard about what it's going to be like to go play in CCL. Robert, thanks for the call, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
There goes Robert. Always talking Galaxy, Robert is. He's always talking Galaxy and coach celebrations on the sideline, being on television. He didn't have an answer for where is Preki. All right, suddenly you guys decide to call Roberto. You're my man in Connecticut. What's up?
Hey, Jason. I was speaking with Brian Scretta the other day, and he was talking about how he believes that the United States won't beat Mexico in the at the Rose Bowl in October because of the the lack of quality that the United States have compared to Mexico. What do you think has to be done with this United States team moving forward? You know, what changes do you think have to be made? Do you think certain people should be called up? Who should be out, et cetera, et cetera?
I don't know that this is going to work because I can't predict the future, Roberto. But if I was in charge of that game, if they fired Jurgen Klinsmann today and gave me the job, first of all, they would need to be committed to a psychiatric ward after that. But if they did, I would go with experienced guys. I don't know that I would play Matt Beisler necessarily, but I would certainly start Omar Gonzalez in that game. I would make sure that Michael Bradley's influence is not limited by playing him too high up the field. Obviously you're going to start Clint Dempsey. I'm probably playing something relatively conservative sounding, but the point is that I want my team to be comfortable. I want them to understand their responsibilities. So if I talk to my team and they say we work best in the diamond, or we work best with a flat 4-4-2, then that's, you know, I'm going to listen to that. I'm starting Michael Bradley. I'm probably starting Kyle Beckerman, even though that's a little bit dodgy at this point. I want Jesse's artist on the field, but I don't know if using him as a winger is the best use of him. I have Aaron Johansson. Oh, man, see, that's the thing. I'd have to look at it. I mean, really, what I think is most important here is putting the team out in a way that they know how to play, in a way they understand, with plenty of defensive help for center backs who, again, may not have played together a lot, because Klinsmann, he hasn't brought the foundation to this game. I mean, if there was a foundation, they probably would have done better in the Gold Cup. So now in the Confederations Cup playoff, you have a determination to make. Do we change things up for the sake of changing things up because they didn't work in the Gold Cup? Or do we go to sort of some established players in places? Alejandro Bedoya on the right, Fabian Johnson at left back. Okay, now I need a right back. Maybe Brad Evans is playing right back for me because I trust him more. I mean, I think that the way to go in this game, unfortunately, because of what Klinsmann has done to this team, is pretty conservative.
Do you think that the lack of rest heading into the match against Panama that Monday night maybe played a factor, having qualification already been secured?
I think that Jurgen Klinsmann overtrains his players, and that's a factor in tournaments.
Yeah. I think that was the reason.
I mean, rest is an obvious thing to point to, but I've heard from enough people that he overtrains. I mean, not just trains them and gets them fit, and now, okay, we're a well-oiled machine, but overtrains them. And, you know, I don't want to make excuses for anybody, but very smart soccer people have pointed out that several players on this team who are otherwise good players have failed to show up at their regular levels in tournaments in compact schedules because of the way Jurgen Klinsmann prepares his teams, which is train, fitness. Then they don't have, again, they don't have that base of understanding of how to play together to go win a game, and now they're overtrained, and their legs are rubbery, and crap, we're in trouble.
I think that's going to be probably a factor if he's going to continue that way against Mexico, heading into the Mexico match, since they're all going to be playing in their respective leagues. That's going to be a factor now.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully he doesn't have an opportunity to overtrain them ahead of that game. I mean, let's just hope that doesn't happen. You know what I'm saying? Like and again, the point is about extended camps. So it's about the World Cup last year, the Gold Cup this year, not necessarily about these one-off games or these two-game windows where he has them for 3 days. There's only so much you can do in 3 days. And hopefully they are training on some level over tactics, really talking about, they don't have to be in training doing tactics, they can be in meetings doing tactics, but hopefully they're at least talking about those things on some level. So, you know, if this is a one-off game in October, you've got the MLS players who are pushing towards the end of the season, qualification for the playoffs, you got the European-based players who are already into their campaign a couple of months, this should be a good window for fitness to not be a factor for the United States. They should be ready to go. Then it's just a matter of whether or not Klinsmann puts him in position to win based on the lineup and the formation and the tactics.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they should also, if they do win that match, they should probably take it a little bit easier in the World Cup qualifying match, considering the teams that they would be facing.
Possibly. I mean, again, that November date, November 23rd is the first game of the fourth round of qualifying, and they're going to face the winner of St. Vincent and the Grenadines and Aruba. So very likely a pushover team, and maybe he does have an opportunity to bring in and cycle through some of these young players that we're supposed to be preparing for 2018.
Yeah, how about that, Matt? It's going to be played at Busch Stadium.
Yes, it is.
That's going to be interesting.
Yes, it is. It's going to be on a baseball venue. There's probably nothing in this world that offends me more than soccer on a baseball stadium field, but whatever, you know? The people of St. Louis will have a good time. I'm sure they'll show up in big numbers. Maybe they'll help them get an MLS team.
I wouldn't be surprised if they play one in Yankee Stadium.
Oh, God. I hope that doesn't happen. There was rumors of a U.S. women's game there. I hope that doesn't happen either. Roberto, I got to run. Appreciate the call, man.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks, Jason.
Roberto in Connecticut. That's going to close us out on a Tuesday. Thank you very much for listening to Soccer Morning here on WorldSoccerTalk.com. Thank you to producer Trevor for producing some pretty awesome images of where is Preki. Because where is Preki? Nobody knows where Preki is. Where is Preki? Go to Soccer Morning. Sorry. Go to WorldSoccerTalk.com. No, that's not right. Go to Backheel.com/store to buy a mug. Go to WorldSoccerTalk.com for a bunch of other stuff and the show. Go to Instagram and follow Soccer Morning on Instagram, because that's a thing now. And I'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye.
My heart on every cursive letter. Tell me why the hell no one is here.